Hello, listeners. Welcome to Season 5 of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Alexia Gordon, award-winning author and host of the show. Every other Thursday, I chat with an author writing on the not-so-gritty end of the crime fiction spectrum. If you prefer your mystery without hardcore sex and violence, join us in The Cozy Corner. Welcome. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host of the podcast. Erica Ruth Neubauer joins me in the corner today to chat about Danger on the Atlantic, a Jane Wonderly mystery. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me, Alexia.
Danger on the Atlantic is the fourth Jane Wonderly mystery. So what adventure is Jane sailing into this time?
Well, this time it is. So we left off with murder at Wedgefield Manor, where they were in England, dealing with some family issues and a murder on an estate. It was a manor house mystery. And so in this one, we are, they're cruising across the North Atlantic, and they are both looking for a German spy. And she is trying to help a woman who essentially is being gaslit on the boat.
Now, as you mentioned, your story is set on an ocean liner crossing from across the Atlantic from Southampton to New York.
Yes.
Now, while the ship, the Olympic, is certainly more mobile than a snowbound English country house or an isolated island, the murder on a ship does still kind of pay homage to the classic mystery theme of a group of people trapped someplace with the murderer. So how did you kind of play with this theme to make it your own?
Actually, I've done it in all of the books so far, to be honest. I really enjoy that aspect of the traditional mystery. I like having all of your characters kind of confined to one area and sort of in forced proximity to each other. And I think the way I play with it and make it my own is a lot with the setting, I think. And each setting has been super different. We had Egypt, we had England, and now on the Atlantic. Yeah.
Now, this story's action takes place in 1926. You know, speaking of classic mysteries, this is a year that falls in that what we often call the golden age of crime fiction, that period between the two world wars. We get a lot of the now classic crime writers like Agatha Christie, Josephine Tay, Niall Marsh, just to name a few. So how did the classics of crime fiction, or at least that sort of crime fiction of that period, influence Danger on the Atlantic?
They have been a huge influence on my entire series, actually. I grew up watching old Agatha Christie movies and reading the books. When I was probably in middle school, I read a lot of the Agatha Christie. In later years, I read a bunch of like Niall Marsh and the Dorothy Sayers, and some of the men as well. But that whole era of both books and, masterpiece mystery, all of those set in the 20s were a huge influence on me. And for this book also, I was also influenced by the movie, Dangerous Crossing. It's a noir movie from the 40s, is where I got some of my ideas.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, it's little known. It's in black and white, but it's pretty good.
Is it called Dangerous Crossing?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of a tie-in for folks who want to watch a movie to go with the book.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to stir up a controversy here. Who's your favorite Marple?
Oh, my goodness. I can't remember her name. It was, I'm actually going to look it up. What's your favorite Marple? Do you have one?
Tie between Geraldine McEwen and Julia McKenzie. They were the two who played Marple on the BBC series.
Yes, that is exactly what I just looked it up. And mine is the first one. Mine is Geraldine McEwen.
And I know that's controversial because most people say Joan Hickson, who played her back in the 80s or 90s, but I have to admit that the two more modern ones are kind of tied for my favorite.
Same. I really liked, because I watched a lot of those in the 80s, but I really liked the update. I thought they did a really nice job.
Now, going back to cruise ships, the transatlantic crossing between Southampton and New York, and also, you know, in the other direction, is actually an iconic voyage. You can still actually make that crossing on the Cunard Line ship, the Queen Mary II.
Yep, I did that.
Oh, cool. I'm jealous. I've booked one for next year, and you've already been, so I'm like totally jealous now.
yeah.
What was your trip like?
It was, you know what, I would not recommend doing it at the time of year that I did it. I tried to do, because it was a research trip, so I tried to do it as close to when the book actually happened, which was like November, late September, like November. And it is a rather unpleasant time to be on the North Atlantic. It is cold and it's windy and it's mostly gray and the boat does a lot of rocking. So I would recommend doing it sometime in the summer, maybe when you can like take advantage of the pools.
Although I did read an advantage of going during that time of year, you can save money by not getting the balcony cabin because you're not going to go out on your balcony anyway.
That is true. Yeah, there's not much point in going out on your balcony.
Now, you can also do what I'm actually doing is I booked a special vintage style crossing through a company that specializes in vintage cruises, Ahoy Vintage Cruises, I should say. And they're having bands like the Dandy Wellington Orchestra is the one that I'm going to hear. And so they kind of create the same type of music similar to what Jane might have listened to. But you know, similar to is not exactly the same as. Right. So, you know, you did a research trip on the modern ship, but how did you recreate the flavor of what it would actually have been like in 1926 as opposed to, you know, 2000s when you've got internet and things like that?
Right. Also, that sounds amazing, Alexia. Your trip, that sounds great.
I'm so looking forward to it.
Right? Oh my gosh. You know, I actually approach research for these kind of all the same ways that I start reading a lot of books about like the period and about the setting. So for Danger on the Atlantic, I found a bunch of books about the Olympic and found a lot of pictures from like of the interior of the Olympic around from the 1920s. One of the books had like great, and like it had like later periods too, but like had great photographs and illustrations of what the ship actually looked like during that time period. And I also read some books that were written by like a ship captain who did captain large ships during that period, just to kind of get an idea of what it was like, and how the crew and like the passengers might have interacted. So yeah, I do a lot of like straight up reading for research, which I find really fun.
And I mean, I didn't know the Olympic was a real ship. So that's pretty cool that you have like a real ship in the book.
It is. It's the sister to the Titanic, actually. So it was built almost, I think it was built identically to the Titanic, except after the Titanic sank, they did updates to like the bulk, I don't know, the bulwark down below, they updated it to kind of compensate for the problems that the Titanic had, which was why it sank.
Make it more iceberg proof?
Yes.
Yes. Now the other thing that I suspect, you know, is real, is that you have Jane and Redvers onboard ship searching for German spies. Now, this is 1926, which is well before World War II. So German espionage is something that we might not realize was going on, but probably was, I'm guessing. So what was Germany up to in the late 20s that they were spying on people?
This was actually sparked because I read that I was just looking for something that would be relevant for that time period, for like that a spy would want. And I learned that Robert Goddard, who was a scientist in the United States.
Goddard Space Flight Center.
Exactly. In the 1920s, he did the first rocket-fueled like liquid jet. It's, you know what, it's real sciencey. But he did have the first test flight for this specific type of like of rocket. And he was concerned that the Germans were going to steal the technology. And I think even in later years, he claimed that they had. So that's what sparked it for me, is him thinking that it was the possibility. And me trying to, and then me playing with, well, what would happen if they had been trying to, if it hadn't been a complete secret and had gotten out.
So Cozies can appeal to STEM advocates as well as mystery advocates.
Exactly. And maybe somebody can explain the rocket part of it much better than I just did.
Jane is working in an official capacity as an undercover investigator, as opposed to a pure Miss Marple type amateur who's drawn into an investigation for more personal reasons. So, and there's this kind of popular image of women, you can't see me making the air quotes, back then, not being employed in professional roles, but in reality, a lot of women had paid jobs, especially during World War I, and they often kept those jobs after the war, especially in England, where so many of the working age men had been killed. They even somewhat unkindly referred to them as surplus women. So what did you uncover about women's paid employment during those interwar years that you found that was interesting in your research?
You know, it's one of the reasons I actually chose to set my books in the 1920s is that I think that that interwar period is so interesting because women were pushing against those social boundaries. And I think that's fun to play with. I think things went kind of went backwards after World War II to a more traditional roles. But like there was a lot of women entering the workforce and going out and partying and having sex and smoking and drinking and doing things that, you know, previous generations were pretty shocked by. But I liked that it was a period where women were kind of pushing against the social constrictions of previous generations. And that's kind of why it's one of the reasons I picked the 20s. And I guess I haven't come across anything super interesting as far as women's employment. I think, you know, they were entering pretty traditional roles. But I think it opened it up for me to be able to have Jane kind of do this sort of thing. And I'm hopefully I can find a way to have her do it continue to work in a less amateur, maybe slightly more professional capacity.
I have to admit, I do sometimes imagine some, you know, someone from the Victorian or Edwardian era just kind of looking at, you know, who would have been kids in the 20s yelling whatever the Edwardian equivalent of get off my lawn was.
Exactly.
So kids today don't actually change all that much from kids yesterday.
Nope, not really.
But what one thing that has changed some, maybe not as much as we'd like, but some is the significance of social class. And one thing that does come up in your story is the different classes of cabin on board the ship. Yes. Now, these days, you know, we think of, you know, first, business, and economy on a plane, but it doesn't really have much meaning other than who gets the overhead bins first. But back in the 20s, I mean, that really meant something. You know, the where your cabin was on the ship was a reflection of kind of where you were in life. So those social class distinctions, which were really significant then, how do you kind of use that to add to the tension of your story?
I did find this interesting was that after the First World War, so by the time this story takes place, some of the ships had sort of upgraded the second class, and there's not really steerage anymore, like what would have been the third class before the war. So they had upgraded slightly for the lower classes, and it was becoming more, I think, a little cheaper for people to make those voyages. But there still was a huge distinction between second class and first class. And frankly, the only reason Jane gets to use first class is because it was being paid for her. Because she's not, does not come from wealth. And I used it because a couple of my characters actually were in the second class. So it was more difficult to locate them. And there would have been stigma for, you know, like restrictions against them venturing into the first class area. So it did help add to tension to, you know, trying to track down people in different parts of the ship.
And another thing you did was sort of a juggle two mysteries in one book. And you've got the mystery of the missing husband. You've also got the German spy aspect. So how'd you blend a more traditional whodunit with an espionage case that's more commonly thought of as maybe a suspense or a thriller?
This was the first time that I actually tried to do that. The previous two books, I had just been straight one mystery. And I hope I pulled it off successfully, but it was kind of a tricky balance to make sure that you had enough elements of each so that you didn't forget what was going on in either of the storylines. And I actually work with a freelance editor, Zoe King, and she really helped me in the revision process. She really helped me pull those threads tighter and make sure that I had a good balance between those two storylines, and could really pick out like, hey, you're kind of, you know, in this part, like we've kind of forgotten what's happening. So you need to, you know, pull those threads through here. And I think, so that was really helpful for me.
Is her name was Zoe King?
Yep. Zoe Quinton King. She's a fantastic freelance editor.
So for anyone listening who needs a freelance, you've now had an endorsement. So
yep.
And so sort of circling back a bit to the fact that the story's action takes place on a ship, and you kind of touched on this where, you know, having some characters in second class made them harder to find. You know, what other challenges did you face in having spies, missing people, and murder in what, you know, amounts to a very constrained sort of geographic location, this metal thing in the middle of the ocean? I know in your acknowledgments, you mentioned you had to make the crossing a little bit longer than it actually would have been in real life. Were there any other things you sort of had to tweak in order to have, you know, all these things going on in a small space, small compared to the ocean space?
Yeah. You know, I think that was the only thing that I really struggled with was I did have to make it a little bit longer. Just for plotting, because it would have been 7 days, I believe. That's how long I was on the ship. I think that was the only issue. Because like I said, I enjoy working in within those constraints of a you know, one space. I think it'll actually be harder if I try to move on and write something where it's sprawling and can be anywhere.
I guess do you feel like you have sort of more control over what's happening if they're all in one space?
Yeah.
Hey, and speaking of expanding, what's next for Jane Wonderly?
Well, I believe I am getting a contract for a couple more books. So that's exciting. And yay! Next she will be going to Istanbul. That will be book 4 will be in Istanbul. Intrigue in Istanbul is the working title right now. I've got a rough draft of it. And so this spring will be working on that. And after that, I think there'll actually be a Christmas novella.
Oh, cool.
Right.
And do you think you'll have her travel for Christmas? It seems to be the a theme to sort of maybe help readers vicariously visit all these exotic places.
Right. I think, unfortunately, but I think for a Christmas, they'll be back in England. and then going forward, even from there, I think after Istanbul, I think I'm going to go to maybe a remote Scottish island. And then I'm thinking maybe somewhere here in the States, like New Orleans after that.
Oh, New Orleans in the maybe late 20s, early 30s ought to be exciting.
Interesting, right?
And to sort of tie themselves over until Jane's next adventure, where can people buy a copy of Danger on the Atlantic?
It comes out in March and they can buy it. Oh boy. Anywhere you're buying books, you'll probably be able to buy signed copies if you want from Boswell Books in Milwaukee. If you go to their website, they're my local independent bookstore, and they always have signed books from me.
And where can readers connect with you to find out maybe, you know, where Jane's headed next and what you're up to? And
I'm pretty active on Instagram. I have a Erica Ruth Neubauer author account. And also I would say probably on Facebook. I also have an author page that they can connect to.
And do you have a website you want to share?
I do. It is ErikaRuthNeubauer.com.
That's N-E-U-B-A-U-E-R.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join me today, Erica.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. My guest today was Erica Ruth Neubauer, author of Danger on the Atlantic, a Jane Wonderly mystery. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Alexia Gordon, award-winning author and host of the show. Tune in next time for another chat with an author writing on the lighter side of crime. Until then, goodbye.